AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply that proves that award season really is a year-round event. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey there.
And Vanity Fair's film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
So last week saw the release of a sequel that no one asked for with Independence Day Resurgence, which nobody liked either, and got creamed by Finding Dory at the box office, of all things. But we have at least two Roland Emmerich apologists here in the room, and we wanted to talk about why at least Richard and I keep coming back to the director of the original Independence Day, but also Stonewall and 10,000 BC and some other terrible movies, and what might happen for him next after Independence Day Resurgence kind of flopped. From there, we'll venture to the total other side of the box office spectrum and talk about what's looking like the art house hit of the summer, at least so far, The Lobster. But first, the week in Oscar news, which involves looking at another box office flop. Richard, you saw Free State of Jones. I did not and may not have even known it existed if I hadn't read your review. What happened there?
I don't know what happened there. It's a movie from STX, which is this new sort of mid-budget studio that has been profiled in The New Yorker.
Profile in New Yorker.
Yeah, and a really fascinating one that people should read, just kind of about how financing is working for this one company in LA. So yeah, it was this $50 million project from Gary Ross is the director who did the first Hunger Games movie and Seabiscuit and Pleasantville. He's had a really kind of weird career. But it's this prestige Civil War drama starring Matthew McConaughey based on a real guy who from southeastern Mississippi who basically started his own sort of militia to fight against the Confederacy and later aligned with the Union because, you know, the Confederacy was stealing, taking horses and food from local farms to feed the troops. And they were sort of rejecting that kind of authority, basically.
So noble historical story.
McConaughey. And there's like an element of civil rights in there because the real guy, his name is Newton Knight. He married a former slave of his grandfather's and basically helped start this kind of all-black community in Mississippi. He was the leader of a regiment of the Union Army during Reconstruction that was mostly black. And so he, you know, had this sort of more progressive racial attitude than many people in that place at that time. So the movie tries to sort of synthesize all of that into something big and stirring. But it's just, I don't know, it just doesn't, it feels very odd.
Does it feel too old-fashioned, like white savior slave drama? Like,
there's a big element of that, and I think that especially in a year when The Birth of a Nation is coming out, mm-hmm. which tells a story that takes place about 30 years prior in the 1830s, but about a slave rebellion. And that movie is, you know, written, directed, starring, produced by people of color. And this movie, Free State of Jones, is not.
Yeah.
So it just feels a little bit, yeah, like that white savior kind of thing. There are a lot of scenes where Matthew McConaughey sort of ministers to his troops, and some of whom are black. And it just feels a little like, yeah, like he's sort of this deity and they're kind of all worshipful of him.
Yeah. I mean, even after 12 Years a Slave, like most people haven't seen Birth of a Nation, but 12 Years a Slave was a reasonably big hit. Like, mm-hmm. like they're just mm-hmm. it feels like the time is not now for white guy helping black people in Civil War.
Yeah. Sorry. And the thing about it is, you know, obviously because the historical record is what it is, like they can't, we don't have necessarily record of everyone from that era. So they could have kind of invented a character, like maybe like a freed slave or an escaped slave. Like, I just feel like they could have balanced it out somehow, and they didn't at all. And I think that that's a really strange impulse, especially in 2016.
You're saying, like, it's not necessarily a bad thing to have a story about a white guy who helps black slaves.
He's a real person, yeah.
But if you're not going to also have some black characters with agency and rounded. Right. development, then you're really starting to look like an anachronistic thing that we thought we put behind us.
That's exactly right. And I think because, you know, with these kind of biopics, like they have to pad out the narrative with made up stuff. I mean, we don't know what these people were doing every day of their lives, but all of that padding out favors Matthew McConaughey's character. And it's like, well, you could have given some of that to somebody else. So there is the Marshall Ali from like House of Cards, great actor. He plays basically Knight's kind of second in command, who is an escaped slave, and great actor. It's a potentially good role, but it just like kind of just they don't give it to him. So and then from a marketing perspective, like why they released it in
middle
June,
of summer,
and like they barely kind of gave promo to it. Like I feel like there weren't a lot of ads or whatever. So it's just a very odd movie that I think on paper with the director, with the star, especially, you know, this was his first real post Oscar movie. And
yeah, well, Interstellar kind of became, I mean, that did pretty well. Like he's had a pretty, I mean, he's had a really flawless track record between, in the last 5 years.
It just, it looked like it was going to be something big and it just isn't. And it's one of those movies that kind of just fell through the cracks. And, you know, for good reason in some cases.
Mike, are we worried about the state of the McConaissance?
Well, I was just going to say, is this why McConaughey's talking wistfully about True Detective?
It very well might be. Honestly.
Yeah, this might be what gets us True Detective 3.
It was good back when. Yeah, but is that what we want from him? Or, given how True Detective
Time is
two
a flat circle.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think he can survive one flop easily. It made $7.5 million, which is not great for a big wide release. But this is a weird move all around, it seems.
Yeah, but yeah, it doesn't feel like the kind of thing you'd pin on McConaughey not having box office pull.
No, except for his passion project. So he was like a big driving force behind it, but I don't think
he was.
How are you going to sell like a Civil War historical drama in the middle of summer? No,
it's also, I mean, this is probably not evident from the trailers or anything, but like the movie is also has a real kind of libertarian, very pro-gun streak in it.
Oh.
Which like that's bad timing.
Well, you know, the more you talk about it, it does sound like slightly strangely coming from Gary Ross, but it sounds like one of those movies that's part of the reason that they're not worried that they might be quote unquote problematic is that they're really aiming toward that sort of flyover Trump Brexit audience.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, that thinks that the real racism problem in America is like racism against whites.
Yeah.
And I don't want to totally make fun of those people because I think that, you know, I've been reading a lot about it in the wake of Brexit and I think that they are suffering from their own, you know, nightmare situation these days and totally generally overlooked by, you know, Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
But
totally.
It sounds like it just didn't connect with them either.
Yeah,
so
no.
It just didn't connect
the
with
American
anybody.
The American sniper crowd, maybe that's the Hollywood terms to put it in.
Right, right. That's nicer than the Mel Gibson Passion of the Christ crowd, but probably ultimately similar crowds.
Yeah. Well, he's a...
American sniper crowd, exactly.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's like
McConaughey's kind of like seemingly, that's his vibe a little bit, or could be.
There are movies aimed toward the American sniper crowd, like, you know, the Mark Wahlberg Boston bombing movie. Like, those things are coming regularly. So that's, like, definitely an audience that people are trying to tap into. I don't know how much Free State of Jones tried to get there, but they clearly...
I also think that it's a terrible title.
Yeah.
It is.
That doesn't help.
So that's the end of the Oscar buzz for that.
Yeah, I would say that's about it. And, you know, it's not a terrible movie. There's some really good filmmaking there and some good performances. So it's probably worth seeing when it, you know, shows up on... you know, Showtime on demand in
like
6 months.
In like, we're like 2 months.
But I love when I can cross a title off my list of things I have to see for Oscar season.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, it was worth a Tuesday evening.
Yeah. This is one of the great things about having Richard around, you know, is save us 2 hours. That's actually 2:20 too. Just save us 2:20.
From this day forward, we declare the land north of the Pascagoula Swamp, south of Enterprise, and east of the Pearl River to the Alabama border to be a free state of Jones. Yeah. And as such, we do hereby proclaim and affirm the following principles. Number one, no man ought to stay poor so another man can get rich. Number two, no man ought to tell another man what he's got to live for or what he's got to die for. Number three, what you put in the ground is yours to tend and harvest, and ain't no man ought to be able to take that away from you. Number four, every man's a man. You can walk on two legs, you're a man. It's as simple as that.
So it's been 20 years since Roland Emmerich basically, and the summer blockbuster had been defined by Jaws, but Independence Day came out in 1996 and I think really set a new standard for a 4th of July movie and kind of how big the hype could be around a summer blockbuster. And since then, he's built a career on the kind of gigantic, really dumb movies that Oscar season basically exists to counteract. But Richard, you and I have talked about this repeatedly. We kind of really love Roland Emmerich, at least want good things from him.
Yeah, because he's made some great movies. I mean, yeah. You know, they're not high art necessarily, but their own kind of art. I mean, Independence Day in 96, like, as much as we've come to kind of bemoan the movies where a whole city is destroyed and it doesn't really mean anything anymore, kind of like Batman versus Superman mm-hmm. style, like, Independence Day sort of invented that in those trailers where they blow up the White House and then the Empire State Building. That was like crazy at the time,
yeah.
You know? So he's, you know, very good at that kind of, Emmerich is really good at that kind of spectacle, but he's also made some great kind of traditional disaster movies like 2012 and The Day After Tomorrow
mm-hmm.
That have, you know, they sort of feel like something from the 70s and they're just fun, and he gets, you know, fun actors to be in, you know, his movies, and they have a sort of easy appeal to them, I would say. He's also made some clunkers, which is why we have this kind of love-hate relationship with him.
Yeah, well, and for White House, or for Independence Day Resurgence, which we both saw last week, and, you know, some Americans saw it, but not many.
Not many.
I didn't really have high hopes, and I don't know if you did either. Like, this one kind of felt like a stinker from the start.
Yeah, no, I think it was a bad idea to begin with. I think it was probably too much time had passed, and, you know, people sort of... The original movie seems kind of quaint, actually, if you watch it now.
It's on HBO Go. I watched like an hour of it before Game of Thrones on Sunday, and it's so charming.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. And, like, you know, it was Will Smith. I think he'd been in movies before. He'd been in Bad Boys before. But this was really his, like, hello world, like, star-making mm-hmm. performance. And it's so good. He's so charming in it. And Jeff Goldblum and Bill Pullman and Vivica Fox and Mary McDonnell. Like, it's a good, fun cast. So, yeah, when they announced
this,
Judd Hirsch, it seemed like kind of a shameless cash grab, and it is, except the grab part didn't work, or isn't working.
Mike, your nostalgia tends to be different from mine and Richard's, just for an age thing. Does Independence Day have any resonance for you at all, the original?
No, not for me. I will say that I once had lunch with him when he was working on Anonymous.
Oh, yeah.
His William Shakespeare's
identity
passion project.
Yeah.
And he was very, you know, it was very kind of almost poignant that he was talking about how he'd made all these disaster movies, but this is the story he really wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not I think that movie is, I would like to hear your defense of it. I don't think it really works, but it was kind of enjoyable, and it was fun to see an action director recreate Elizabethan England, as bizarre as the whole thing was.
Yeah.
And then I remember, I thought White House Down, which was maybe the second to the next film, two films later or something for him. I thought it was actually a pretty good movie.
I love White House Down.
Yeah.
And it's also in rotation on FX a lot lately, which is like kind of the perfect place for it.
Yeah. And again, the fun is seeing him recreate something instead of the Globe Theater. It's the White House.
Right.
So he's obviously, he can really create these worlds, but it seems like when it goes off, you know, is he a master of kind of pacing and plot and character? I don't know. Maybe not as much.
You know? Yeah. I mean, White House Down was a great movie that did very badly at the box office. And I think, you know, Olympus Had Fallen had come out probably 3 months prior sort of kind of overshadowed what I think is a far superior movie.
Oh, yeah. Olympus Has Fallen and somehow got a sequel, which is infuriating.
Yeah. That didn't do well.
No.
Anonymous is a weird movie. I watched that with a friend kind of on a whim a couple years ago. And it's historically bullshit. I mean, it's
right.
Not.
It's the idea that this guy wrote Shakespeare's work.
Yeah, yeah.
Not Christopher Marlowe, but kind of an unknown.
A duke or an earl or something.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's this Stratfordian, kind of anti-Stratfordian movie about the authorship of Shakespeare's plays. And it was this great kind of British cast. And I don't know, it's really stylishly done. And it feels, like you said, you know, having lunch with him. By the end, it has this real kind of moving coda. Like, it feels like a passion project.
Oh,
it really was. Responded to that in a cool way.
And Reese Ifans is really good in it. He's, like, giving his all as the guy who was writing all of Shakespeare's work.
Exactly.
And Rafe Spalding is really funny, like Patsy Shakespeare. So there's a lot of good acting in it.
It's a lot of good acting.
And they knew it wasn't going to make a lot of money. It was basically like, go ahead, Roland, make this crazy thing.
Oh, yeah, it was funded by Sony.
But I love that he was also kind of like, but I can't do it for less than $50 million. And they're like, well, all right.
Yeah.
He literally has no idea how to do that.
Yeah, I don't know how much Stonewall cost, but like that's kind of the next.
It's not like Joss Whedon making Midsummer Night's Dream like on the weekend. This was like a giant. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so Richard, you saw Stonewall, and many people famously loathed it, including yourself.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, that movie has its many, many problems. But what makes you kind of like have faith in the guy after something that egregious?
Well, that just felt so out of his wheelhouse that I was like, eh, he doesn't, you know, like that was just like not what he's good at. And so I just kind of trusted him to, or trust him still maybe, to come back to what he's good at, which, you know, although the more we talk,
except
the more,
now he's well, not good
right
at
exactly
it.
Yeah. And the more we talk, the more I realize that like he's done some varied stuff that I kind of like all of it. So yeah, I don't know what his real like true focus is. I think he has a movie, his next movie is called Moonfall. And it's
sure.
about what if the moon fell to Earth? I honestly think
sounds
that's
kind of good.
That's kind of what happens.
I'm intrigued. Like, I'm intrigued.
Like, wait, yeah, totally. But that's kind of what happens in Independence Day, where the new one where the ship comes and like drags Liam Hemsworth from the moon to Singapore and then to England,
oh, that's
and then
right.
they
yeah.
get dropped.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not super sure what happened in that scene.
Yeah, this big alien ship that's like the size of the Atlantic Ocean descends on Earth and. Yeah, this movie, Independence Day Resurgence, is just a little too unwieldy, and they just are going, they're trying to kind of make up for the lack of originality and surprise that the first one had, and Will Smith, frankly, by just kind of doing big Transformers-esque, you know,
yeah.
stuff that doesn't work, and, you know, yeah. it feels kind of pointless.
And the thing that's great about, I think, a lot of Roland Emmerich's movies is that they have these weird touches in them, like in the original Independence Day, casting Judd Hirsch at all is like such yeah. a stroke of genius, and he's back in this one, and there's this great moment near the end of the movie where he winds up driving a school bus full of kids, half of whom are wearing like animal hats.
Across like the white
across
sands
the, like,
of
the,
desert.
Across the Utah salt flats, and yeah. it's so weird. And inspired, but so much of the rest of the movie, you got Liam Hemsworth and the guy who plays Will Smith's son, who like is such a non-entity that like
yeah.
you can't even process that he's there. There's so much of it that just feels lazy, and there's a lot of green screen and a lot of like not wanting to put the effort in there.
Yeah.
So that when like Charlotte Gainsbourg shows up doing stuff, you're just like, all right, so that's the good stuff, but like why can't it balance out?
Yeah, I hope Charlotte Gainsbourg likes her new summer home in outside Paris or whatever
she
got
with that.
Whenever she did this movie.
Yeah, her and the guy who was the tour guide in White House Down, who's he looks like John Oliver, like they're just they follow Jeff Goldblum around for the whole movie.
Oh yeah, that's right.
It's a really odd movie, Mike. I can't I don't know if I can even explain to you how strange it is.
I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm loving this episode because I'm crossing another one off my list.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
you guys saved me now 5 hours.
Yeah, it's
in this conversation.
I mean, we may talk later in the summer about what a weird summer movie season it's been. But when yeah. something like this that seems like such a sure bet falls apart like that, it kind of bums you out.
This was supposed to be just the money machine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we'll just, you know, crank it out, and it didn't pan out. One thing that is interesting about the movie, and that's interesting about Emmerich's kind of oeuvre recently, is that, you know, he's an out gay guy, and he, but he has sort of avoided those topics in his filmmaking a lot.
Except for Stonewall.
Well, then yeah. came Stonewall. and now, well, and then Harvey Fierstein is in the first Independence Day and sort of unceremoniously is killed and sort of, and that's played as a joke, which is a little weird. But in this movie, we have Brent Spiner from mm-hmm. Star Trek reprising his role as the kind of scientist in the underground, you know, Area 51.
Who we all thought died, I think.
Who we all thought died, but turns out he's just in a coma. And it, as the movie unfolds with his character, it kind of becomes clear that he and the other scientist are, in fact, an item.
Which I did not catch, honestly,
no.
at all
they
watching
They call each
the
other
movie.
Baby a couple times, and then there's this sort of emotional thing at the end. And, you know, as sort of odd and sort of, you know, it's understated, let's say, as it is, I think it's kind of cool that he's teasing that out, you know.
Yeah.
And so maybe going forward, like, there'll be more of that. And so that's another, that's another bias of mine, like, with him. It's just, like, it's just cool, like, that there's this, you know, out gay director who makes these big commercial,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of mass appeal kind of things, I think.
Well, has there been a big action movie with an out gay protagonist?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, the X-Men movies and operate in metaphor, which I don't think
yeah.
really count. But
well,
yeah,
I think that's what Roland Emmerich should do next.
Yeah. yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, Moonfall, the moon can fall on a gay person. It doesn't have to just
it's
fall
be.
On a straight person.
Odds are it will. I mean, it's big enough yeah. that I feel like it would hit a lot of people.
Sounds like the yeah. name of, you know, a certain kind of performer, too. Moonfall. Ladies and gentlemen, Moonfall.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I don't know. I still, despite everything that Emmerich has subjected us to in the past few years, I'm not advocating anyone go see this or Stonewall or anything. But you know, if you want to be completist about his body of work, you have to see these.
Watch White House Down, though. That's true underrated gem in this whole crowd.
And as much as he's a crazy person in real life and on Twitter, James Woods in White House Down is this like amazing villain. Like,
yes,
so good.
Yes.
There's Richard Jenkins and William Fichtner in White House Down. I think where like they both are like great character actor villains. So yeah,
Jamie Foxx as
the president. Yeah, so you know he puts on his Air Jordans to run away from the terrorists. Yeah. Jason Clark is the terrorist.
Mentioned Channing Tatum.
I know. Yeah, it's one of like the weirdly best casts of the last couple years. Yeah.
And Maggie good. Gyllenhaal.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's a Secret Service agent.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh boy.
By the way, came out 3 years ago. Like now.
Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. Maggie Gyllenhaal's also enjoying her summer home, so it's really working out well for everybody.
Summer homes all around.
Yeah. Let's just go watch White House Down.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Next week will be a live commentary on White House.
Yeah. Perfect.
Mr. President, Dr. Oaken. You're awake.
Very much so.
Why are they screaming?
No. They're not screaming. They're celebrating.
So as Independence Day Resurgence proved, it's been a kind of rough year for blockbusters so far. You just have to look at the Box Office Mojo top 10 to kind of see that. But independent films, as usual, they're kind of, you know, holding down the quality. And it's been pretty good for them, including at the box office. The Lobster, which is maybe one of the weirdest indie film success stories I can imagine, has done pretty well for itself so far. It's the first English language film from Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos, who made Dogtooth and Alps, kind of a very niche thing up to this point. And the premise is really weird. It's set in a world in which single people are sent to a hotel and given 45 days to find a mate. And if they don't, they are turned into an animal of their choice, which is nice and thoughtful of them. Mike and Richard, you both had anecdotal evidence last time we talked that people are seeking out the Lobster. Richard, I think your mom was one of mm-hmm, them, mm-hmm. who might not otherwise be seeing high concept European art films. It's being released by A24, which has a really good track record with getting odd indie films out there in front of people. And it's made $7.5 million, which is more than twice as much as Everybody Wants Some, a movie that we all loved and I really thought more people had seen. That's such a bummer.
Yeah.
But Mike, what's the secret to you of what's making this movie take off?
I don't know. That's a great question. I can't figure it out. I mean, it won the jury prize at Cannes. I think part
over
of it...
Over a year ago, the Cannes before this
right.
year, which is interesting.
I think A24 maybe is very smart about how they're marketing stuff and aggressive because they're kind of having fun right now. They won 3 Oscars, was it? And they're mm-hmm. like they're sort of in growth mode,
yeah.
which is a good thing. I know the people who mentioned it to me, because I always do think, like, I know there's a whole, like, crowd. I call it, like, the crowd that shows up at Katie's parties. And if they talk about, like, a cool, weird movie, I'm just like, whatever. You're the only person who's ever going to see that.
Film but Twitter, when I think, is another
film
term.
Twitter. But when I see, like, a normal human being with a job tell me, like, oh, I saw The Lobster the other day. I'm yeah. like, what the hell? And two people. But I think partly it's because it was playing in Brooklyn, where, mm-hmm. you know, where people are.
I saw it
are.
At BAM, yeah.
Right, it was playing at BAM for a while. But I don't know. It's so cool because I watched it last night with my fiance, also a person in politics. And at the end of it, she was like, that's really great. Like, that's the kind of interesting movie that I like. And so there's something about it. It's just like it works. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I think Colin Farrell's part of it. It's actually got a really good cast and a lot of people that you're kind of surprised. I mean, people love Rachel Weisz. People mm-hmm. love Colin Farrell. John C. Reilly is in it. But it is sort of like a theater of the absurd. It reminds me of the kind of theater we used to do in college that we thought was like very cool, like the Ionesco, Samuel Beckett stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's also really funny. And then at the end of the day, I think it is a... You kind of can relate to this. It basically is if you got really stoned with your friends and we're like, you know what our society is actually like with relationships? And then you like literally took all of your metaphors and made a movie, right? It's as if we have only X amount of time to find a mate or else we get like sent out into the woods and treated like, you know, pariahs. And then, but you know, it's like it operates on a level of metaphor that's not that far removed from like how it feels to be a human being.
Yeah.
Those are some of my theories.
No, I think that's right, Mike. And I think that this is not to denigrate the movie at all, which I think is great, or to, you know, diminish its intelligence. But I think it is the kind of indie movie that has a weird hook, that has a lot of cool, interesting filmmaking, but is not so arty that it's alienating. I think it finds that perfect sweet spot that something like Eternal Sunshine found, or Being John Malkovich found, you know,
yes.
where you go and you feel kind of like, you know, you're seeing something offbeat, which you noir, but it's also like it's appealing and it feels relatable. And I think that that's a really tricky balance for a movie to strike. And I think that Lanthimos does that very well.
And it's really funny.
And it's really funny and it has a good cast. And yeah, I mean, anecdotally, like I was at a one-year-old's birthday party in Way South, New Jersey this weekend and sitting on a porch and four people there told me they had seen it, and they're not people who are in the film world at all. And then I was at a brunch with a friend from high school on Sunday and with her aunt and, you know, just kind of like, again, people who aren't avid moviegoers, and they had, three of them had seen it, you know. So it just, it has legs and it has really good word of mouth. And, you know, there are a couple of people I've spoken to who are not really high on the movie. They just didn't work for them. But almost everyone I've spoken to has found something really like worth kind of like evangelizing about, which I think
is... And it's a good setup for a debate, right? Yeah, because one of the people who brought it up to me was like, "What'd you think of that?" You know, like people want to talk about it because it's so weird, and it kind of does raise all sort of provocative questions about is our society actually, you know, prejudice against single people, or you know,
says the single.
But wait, does Colin Farrell have some kind of sneaky giant fan base that I'm not familiar with? This, it reminds me of like when I finally figured out that Ewan McGregor was a gigantic international star because of the Star Wars prequels, which sort of shocked me.
I mean, he works a lot and he makes weird choices. Like Colin Farrell is constantly showing up in movies that, like, you know, no one's ever going to see, but he wants to make it because he wants to work with this director. I mean, True Detective season 2.
I mean, is In Bruges enough of like a cult comedy that people would seek out another weird movie with Colin Farrell in it?
In Bruges is, I think, a cult comedy for a lot of people who maybe aren't film buffs, but that movie, it like really resonates with them. Like I've talked to like a lot of like dudes who like really like
that movie. That movie is funny in a much more accessible way than The Lobster, I think. Like Amber's just funny.
Yeah. I also think with Colin Farrell, have you ever met someone who doesn't like him? You know, who like doesn't think he's a good actor, or, you know, he, I don't think he's ever really had
there
that.
There was a time like when 10 years ago. Early on when he was like still the pretty boy guy, when people were like, all right, and he was enough, making, right? And he was getting drunk all the time and making shitty movies.
Yeah, Alexander and that era.
Yeah. But I mean, he since then really worked very hard to, I think, do interesting things. I mean, you know, even True Detective 2, on paper, that was great, and that was a good call on his part, but like, it just didn't work out. But but no, I think he's just like,
so winning in this thing.
Yeah.
And to the point where I was like, if it weren't so understated, I would almost say he had a dark horse chance as at a best picture.
Hey, if we keep talking about it, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah.
Give it a shot.
I could see that. I could see this film like lasting because thanks to this groundswell.
Yeah. And it's been building buzz amongst film Twitter people like us since Cannes last year. It played Toronto. It played, I mean, probably every festival between Cannes.
It was at New York Film Festival. It's been very shrewd about that. Mm-hmm. So what do we think? I mean, is it screenplay? Is that it's probably its best chances, like awards-wise?
Probably.
Yeah. That seems like, that, like you mentioned being John Malkovich in Eternal Sunshine, like that's usually a home for movies like this when it comes to the Oscars, figuring out what in the world to do with them. But A24 is canny. I mean, like you said, Mike, they won
and
three Oscars.
If you get 10 movies in the the Best Picture,
I could
nominees.
See it being a number 9 Best Picture. Yeah. And I could see Rachel Weisz slipping in if there's
so
a weak supporting
good.
Actress thing.
And she's got a couple things coming out this year, so she'll have a lot of sort of movement behind her.
Yeah, she'll have a campaign going for Light Between Oceans too. That's
and the other one where
supporting.
She's the lawyer defending, like, or being sued by a Holocaust denier.
Oh God,
I forget what it's called. She's not the Holocaust denier.
I mean, the score was pretty good.
The score is really good. I think that Olivia Colman, who plays the sort of administrator of the hotel,
right.
she's great, and she's love.
She's got
her.
That night manager mojo now.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So that's.
I also know. The girl who I don't actually know the actress's name, but she plays she marries Ben Whishaw, and she was Hannah.
Yeah.
And she's been kind of growing up on screen. I think she's so funny.
Yeah,
really
everyone's great. It's a good movie, you know, and it's something I saw it at Cannes in 2015, and then again at New York Film Festival a few months later, and you know, so it's been a long time since I've seen it, but it's still with me, and I remember it very vividly. So.
Yeah.
You know, and I've told a lot of people to see it. It has that kind of
That's what it is.
Yeah.
It's you going around telling people what
you've
assembled a $7 million audience.
Yeah.
Oh, we should also say that they did a very fun online marketing campaign where you went to a website and were asked a series of questions. And then it told you at the end what your animal would be, you know, if you were in the world of the movie. And that got passed around on Twitter and Facebook a lot.
Okay.
So they've just been very, like, smart about how they're you know, packaging this odd... I mean, ultimately depressing. What do you guys think? I find that movie sort of sad, but with a sort of a little bit of a comforting kind of pat on the shoulder. Yeah. If you're single,
it's dark as hell. Yeah.
It has the classic ambiguous ending where it's like, do you choose to believe in love or not at the end of the movie? And you kind of have to decide what you think happened.
What would you do for your lover?
I find it more depressing, but also that love is real, which I think is like, for a movie like that to come on the side that like a connection between two people is possible and real and matters is that's saying something.
Yeah.
And that this really arty, interesting kind of, indie world director is saying something very like universally human about like feeling lonely or wanting to be with somebody. You know, that's like everyone can, from the sort of most pretentious cinema buff to just, your average Joe. Everyone is like, oh, yeah, I can relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
So. You know what's wild about Colin Farrell, just looking at his filmography? The last movie he was in was The Winter's Tale. Truly bizarre passion project.
Yeah.
And so it's been that and True Detective season 2 and then Saving Mr. Banks before that. He's had this is why we're all rooting for him. He's like an underdog at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
He had the like Minority Report rise and now he's,
Well, it's inspired casting. It really is.
Oh, yeah.
He's really good. And I wouldn't have expected him to be able to play that, actually. So understated.
It's such a sad sack.
Yeah, yeah. A sad sack.
Well, anyway. Not,
he is
not,
Irish, though.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah. Yeah. And so, it was filmed in Ireland. So
there's that.
Anyway, go see The Lobster if you haven't.
Yeah.
I understand this discussion is a little unpleasant for you, but it is my duty to prepare you psychologically for all possible outcomes. Now, have you thought of what animal you'd like to be if you end up alone?
Yes, a lobster.
Why a lobster?
Because lobsters live for over 100 years. Are blue-blooded, like aristocrats. And stay fertile all their lives. I also like the sea very much. I water ski and swim quite well since I was a teenager.
I must congratulate you. The first thing most people think of is a dog, which is why the world is full of dogs. Very few people choose an unusual animal, which is why they are endangered. A lobster is an excellent choice.
So before we go, let's take a look back at the year that Free State of Jones star Matthew McConaughey won the Best Actor Oscar, that I guess makes us talk about things like Free State of Jones as an Oscar play, even if they're not going to be. At the time, it seemed like no one was going to win other than McConaughey. But looking back at this crop of nominees, there's some interesting choices. So that year, Matthew McConaughey won for Dallas Buyers Club. Then the other nominees were Christian Bale for American Hustle, Bruce Dern for Nebraska, Leonardo DiCaprio for The Wolf of Wall Street, and Chiwetel Ejiofor for 12 Years a Slave. So, guys, who should have won?
Let's remember, Bruce Dern campaigned his ass off.
He did.
For this thing. And people thought he might have a chance just because he knew all those old voters.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to every single opening of every single
Nebraska
envelope.
Was a Best Picture nominee. That's crazy.
Yeah. And then Leo, the fans were really enraged when Leo didn't win.
That was really the loss that sparked that whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's basically why he won.
Why he now has an Oscar. Yeah.
Looking at this list right now, I think McConaughey was great, and Chiwetel also to me was so freaking good in 12 Years.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Chris, I liked American Hustle, but I don't know. That's not a Best Actor.
It's almost weird that he's in Best Actor because you think of that whole movie as being an ensemble.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think Leo got I think arguably Leo got the Oscar for the right movie.
Oh, yeah? You think that The Revenant is the best Leo performance that's been nominated?
I think so. I mean, I didn't really like Wolf of Wall Street. I didn't really get it. And I thought it was kind of repetitive and too long and just
definitely
sort of repulsive
so
in a lot
Revenant.
Of ways. Whereas The Revenant was at least, sure it was too long, but like what he put himself through was, and it was so surprising to me versus this one where it's like, oh, Leo's playing like a pampered asshole who came from nothing. Like, what a shock.
Yeah. Right.
Sorry, but...
No, I know what you mean. It's a tricky list because maybe minus Bale, every one of them has a sort of like, you're like, okay, I could see voting for them because of blank. But I really think that it's, for me, it's between Ejiofor and Bruce Dern. Nebraska was my favorite movie that year. I think it's a really beautiful movie, anchored wonderfully by this performance. But then with Ejiofor, who's really, not that Dern hasn't been, but he's just been, Ejiofor has been so vital and good in so many things in the past 15-ish years that like it was exciting that he got nominated, and that movie, while it won Best Picture, like maybe was a little under awarded that night, I think.
Yeah.
So it would have been nice for him to pick that up too.
Because I mean, Lupita was awarded.
She was the big acting bid for that, which kind of made his campaign kind of an afterthought when he was, you know, being buried under the hype around McConaughey and DiCaprio.
Whereas I feel like he had more to play than she did in a way.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, not to take anything away from anybody, but Lupita's thing seemed to have more to do with her being such a fabulous discovery and instant star.
Yeah, it's the ingenue Oscar, which happens for actresses a lot.
Whereas Chiwetel, I mean, when you think about what just happened in his eyes and on his face over the course of 2 hours, that was really unbelievable. And the transformation from civilized, you know, kind of like free guy to someone being tortured and back again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what about McConaughey, though, Richard? Did you not think that was...
No, I like him in that movie, and I think that, you know, that's a really tricky film to talk about, Dallas Buyers Club, because on the one hand, you know, it highlights a time in American history, and you know, the AIDS crisis in the mid-80s that, like, has sort of been forgotten in kind of popular culture, at least. But it's a movie that does that through the perspective of a straight white guy. That
it's the Free State of Jones of movies about the gay AIDS crisis.
Yeah. and then you know, with the Jared Leto's character, like I certainly know people in the trans community and their allies were upset that they didn't cast a trans actor to play this role of Raylene.
It seems like now, honestly, like three years later, they wouldn't cast a straight guy in that role.
Yeah,
anymore.
I think it just has changed. So it's just hard for me to sort of fully get behind that movie, even though McConaughey's great. You know, I think McConaughey also did the physical thing where he lost all this weight and he was really committed to it. Yeah. And on the one hand, I appreciate that. On the other, it seems sort of shameless and like, you know, kind of like, give me the award. but he didn't seem as hungry for it as other actors, Leo, have seemed. So I don't know. I mean, I think they're all worthy, minus Bale maybe. But I'm going to give it to Edufor.
Well, McConaughey was also coming off this incredible run where he'd had Killer Joe and he'd had Magic Mike and like he'd really been great in a lot of different things. The Paperboy he's great in. So it was kind of like a capper of the McConaissance, like we were talking
about
earlier.
It was the McConaissance.
Everyone was thrilled to love him again after many years of ghosts of girlfriends past.
I mean, if this were a supporting actor for Magic Mike, then I would not be complaining at all. Like that performance, I feel like is the capper of all of them.
I agree.
Then he did what?
Then he gave that speech and everyone was like, that'll be the last Oscar.
Oh, that's right.
You.
I forgot about his speech.
It's somehow, that's an episode to be like campaigns or awards campaigns we were rooting for until the speech. And we were like, oh, wait, we've made a terrible mistake.
But also, can we just quickly talk about, wasn't Bruce Dern arguably maybe a category fraud?
Oh, like he was supporting?
Oh, because like Will Forte was kind
Will
of
Forte
the lead.
Will Forte kind of the lead in that
movie? I mean, that's tricky. I think in the weird way that in some Alexander Payne movies, everyone was a supporting character.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I think you could say the same thing about Election, even though Broderick nominally is, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but no, I think that there is something to that, Mike, also. And, you know, it's a tiny little black and white thing where Bruce Dern just kind of grunts and is mean, which he's been doing for 50 years.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. I'm not mad at the result.
No.
I think Matthew McConaughey can keep his Oscar.
You know, he can keep it.
No matter how many bad speeches
he has. Don't want to hear about it again.
No more
from
speeches
him.
For Hugh McConaughey.
And to my hero, that's who I chase. Now, when I was 15 years old, I had a very important person in my life come to me and say, who's your hero? And I said, I don't know. I got to think about that. Give me a couple of weeks. I come back 2 weeks later. This person comes up and says, who's your hero? I said, I thought about it. You know who it is? I said, it's me in 10 years. So I turned 25 10 years later. That same person comes to me and goes, so are you a hero? And I was like, not even close. No. She said, why? I said, because my hero is me at 35. So you see, every day, every week, every month, and every year of my life, my hero's always 10 years away. I'm never going to be my hero. I'm not going to attain that. I know I'm not. And that's just fine with me because that keeps me with somebody to keep on chasing. So to any of us, whatever those things are, whatever it is we look up to, whatever it is we look forward to, and whoever it is we're chasing, to that I say amen. To that I say all right. And to that I say just keep living, huh? Thank you.
That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you so much for listening. And please rate and review us on iTunes. We appreciate it and it helps us find new listeners. You can find us all at vanityfair.com and on Twitter. I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Rylaws.
And Mike?
Mike_Hogan.
And we're all at Little Gold Men. This episode was produced by Sam Dingman and edited by Tim Einenkel, and thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for most accurate description of a claw game machine in an arcade goes to Richard Lawson.
The grab part isn't working.
Know that fizzy feeling you get when you read something really good, watch the movie everyone's been talking about, or catch the show the internet can't get over? At the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we chase that feeling 5 times a week. We talk about the buzziest movies, TV, music, books, and more. From lowbrow to highbrow to in between, catch the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.